This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good day. Welcome to New Books in Military History. I am Boris Karpa, and we have with us today Vlad Besedovsky, and he will talk to us about a unique book, which is called Uniforms and History of the Soviet Airborne in Afghanistan. And Vlad is a person of who has different types of experience. He's both the director of Safar Publishing, which publishes military history books, and he is, most importantly, also an author of several books on military history and weapons. And most importantly, he is the author of this one, which, as we established, talks about the Soviet airborne in Afghanistan. Vlad, I'm happy to have you here with us today.
Good day, Boris. Thank you for inviting me.
Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about your book. What is it about? What does it bring to the table?
Just a moment. I think we have a technical problem because that's, the recording line on my side is not showing any signs of life.
I can see it. I can see that there are.
Okay, fine then. Hello, Boris. Thank you for inviting me to the podcast. Yes, my name is Vlad. I'm the author of the airborne book, The Soviet Airborne in Afghanistan. And right now I'm in the process of making a couple more books. So this is the only one I have finished. But in 2023, we are planning to publish at least two more books. So yeah, so, oh, sorry, by the end of the next year, so by the end of 2024, I should have about 3 to 4 books published by my name.
That is very good. And you will, of course, be welcome here when you have those books again. But can you tell us a little bit more about the Airborne book? What is it about? What does it bring to the table?
Absolutely. So the Soviet Airborne in Afghanistan is the book which mainly focuses on the on one particular Soviet airborne regiment in Afghanistan, and it depicts all the weapons, uniforms, equipment used at the time by this particular regiment, which pretty much covers all other airborne regiments as well. The book also covers a little bit about the whole situation, about the soldier's life, about the tactics, and so on. But its main focus would be on the photography and to show the equipment and the uniforms at the time.
You know, there's always, we are here, you know, creatures of tradition here. Academics, you know, like soldiers, also creatures of tradition. We always ask, you know, how did you choose the subject for this particular book?
Oh, this is the question I get quite often, and people assume that I have I had some relatives serving in Afghanistan, but that's not the case. For me, it was kind of random. So when I started playing airsoft and doing reenactment back in the day, I got into the group of people who was revolving around this area, around this topic. And as time passed by, I got more and more interested in the topic. My collection of uniforms and equipment started to pile up. And then at some point, I decided that I want to put it in some sort of finished form. So basically, like, to finish off my collection with something instead of just letting it, you know, stay under the bed for eternity. So this is how I chose the subject. This is how the book started.
Well, and from this, you know, from reading this book, I can see that it's undergone, you know, while you were writing it, while you were working on this book, it's undergone a little bit of an evolution. It's clearly started as one of these reenactor books, which we see sometimes, where we know where you just describe the uniforms, the gear, but it's grown beyond this, hasn't it? And Can you tell us a little bit about the work process, about how this book evolved while you were making it?
Yeah, absolutely. This is correct, and you can see it from the book itself that it's been evolving as it was, as the work progress was going on. So at first we were planning to make some sort of a photo album of those people who performed in the project. Well, the project wasn't, we didn't plan to make a book at first. It was just like photo project of making just a couple of different photo impressions of the soldiers of the time. As there were more and more photos coming in, I decided it should be in, again, some sort of finished form. I was thinking more about like a magazine article, but we were getting more and more photos, and it became quite obvious that, let's say, 10 pages or 20 pages in the magazine not going to cut it, and we need some big work, something like, well, at least the magazine itself, but more like a book. Then I had the idea that I should actually make the book on all possible uniforms and equipments and impressions of the Afghan war. We did some work towards that, so we had some impressions of infantry and engineers and Air Force and so on, but it soon became really obvious that for a book like this to be complete, it needs to be ridiculously big. It would be like up to 1,000 pages maybe. So making it in one book wouldn't make any practical sense. So at this point, again, I started narrowing it down. I narrowed it down to airborne, to VDV. Again, it became obvious that it will be really hard to cover all the VDV units in one book. It's, again, would be pretty big, and it would take just a bit too much time to finish it. So I decided to narrow it down to one exact regiment, and this is how I got the book in the form which you can see it now. But overall, yes, the work took me quite some time. I think I was working on it in total of around 5 years. This is a lot, and I wouldn't recommend anyone to to work so long on one project like this one, because it does add a lot of complexity. For example, the photos we've been taking for the book, like if you look at the book now, most of the photos will be from the last 2 years of the work. So the very early ones, we didn't use them because they were just not good enough. We didn't like the standards as we progressed in producing better photographs. And same goes with the text. So when I was writing text back in 2016, 2017, rereading them again in 2020, I didn't like them. I had to sit down and rewrite them completely. This is regular writer's thing, like rewriting and rewriting. This is probably a natural process. But as a person, as a writer, you progress over time. So keeping a project for too long, you just end up redoing it, rewriting and retaking photos, reshaping everything. And this is an infinite process. So you need to have some sort of a plan and put a full stop at some point and publish the book. And this was a hard moment for me to actually finish it off and stop doing any improvements.
Which brings me around to something which I want to ask you, you know, because again, this is a New Books Network, and many people who are in our audience, you know, they are considering, maybe they are working on their own book, maybe they are considering working on their own book, and as somebody who has written the book and who is working on additional books, do you have anything which you would like to tell the audience about your working process, about some of the obstacles which you've overcome?
I can base my experience on this book and on those two more which I'm working on right now. I would definitely say that the main thing is to actually have a plan and to have some sort of a reasonable timetable, which I would advise people to have something between 6 and 12 months to finish off any sort of book project. Oh, at least most of them. I mean, some books would require more time for research, some would require more time for writing, but I would advise everyone to aim for the period between 6 to 12 months. For the reasons I explained in the previous question, so just that you, as the time progresses, you will want to improve the book more, and this can be like an infinite loop.
Yeah, that makes sense. So we need to have a timetable we want to avoid getting into an editing loop of sorts.
Absolutely, absolutely. And so this is how I start my new project now. So basically, I write a table of contents, which is the plan itself, essentially. I do allow myself some reasonable timeline, timetable. Like for one of my books, it's 6 months, and I think we started in very early September. So I'm actually planning to finish a bit earlier by the end of this year. Of course, there are some obstacles in any project, and book would not be an exception. The usual ones would be financial obstacles, technical and motivational. Those are the ones I wrote down for this question. And the financial depends on the project and the book. Again, most books wouldn't really cost you too much to produce.
But if you have photographs, if there are photographs, if there's equipment which you must photograph, and to have this would cost money to accomplish.
Yeah, absolutely. So for me, it was kind of simpler because I got the collection or most of the collection first, and then I decided to take a photo of it. It was so I was spending money on it without having project in mind. It was just a hobby. But starting from scratch, this, of course, would cost a lot of time and a lot of money because just to bring the collection together would take some effort, you know. I would say, but the main obstacle would be the motivational one because it's easy to start something. It's hard to complete it, and especially if you don't have some sort of a goal at the end, like if you don't know why you're doing it. So this is something definitely to think about both before starting the project and during this project. For me, it was not the financial gains were not the main, or it wasn't the motivation at all when I started the project. It only got it became motivational later on when I actually published the book because it was a reasonable success. I would again advise everyone to work on such projects in their free time as a hobby, just to finish it off for yourself and make it like pleasant for yourself. And then if you achieve this, people will like it as well. This I see from quite often from most projects people do.
Well, now I want to turn around to the actual subject of the book itself. And you talk about, you know, the training of the VDV. You talk about how, you know, the ordinary, and you talk about how different VDV soldiers had different duration of training, but the ordinary VDV soldiers, Strelok VDV, the rifleman, he would get training for 2 to 3 months in Fergana. And for people who are not, who have not read the book, Fergana is a town currently in what is today Uzbekistan, and at this time it was part of the USSR. And the soldiers who were going to be sent to Afghanistan, they were trained in this at the training base in Fergana because the climate was considered to be similar. And the sergeants and the specialists, they were trained in other facilities, sometimes for as long as 5 months. But you talk about the fact that when these soldiers, when they would arrive at Afghanistan, they would be placed in training facilities, they were called quarantine facilities, where they would receive more training. And I would like to ask you, do you think that the fact that these facilities existed, do you think it's some kind of admission by the Soviet military that the training with the soldiers prior to this, they got it was not very good? Because if we have these soldiers who are arriving in the combat zone and we're training them more, does this mean that we are admitting that they are not ready?
Yes, this was the case. And actually, I want to elaborate a little bit more about how the training process worked in the Soviet Army. So the whole length of service was 2 years for the Army and the Air Force. The Navy served for 3 years. And the training would either be 6 months, as you mentioned, for the sergeants and specialists, or it could be as short as 2 weeks in the quarantine that wouldn't even involve the Afghanistan. So most units did have basically like quarantine-based training facilities where soldiers would learn the absolute basics within 2 weeks, and then they would be sent to their units, and they would serve as regular soldiers, picking up and training further with their speciality as time went on.
So just to recall, so if you're a regular soldier, you will be trained in the Uchepka, in the original training base for maybe 2 or 3 months, and then you would be in the quarantine.
No. You could be sent to the regiment into the quarantine from day one, basically.
So somebody who is a VDV soldier, they could be actually sometimes sent directly to the unit, directly from where they are recruited, and they just did straight up to Afghanistan, like this?
This did happen as well. In the first couple of years of war, this was the case. So the fresh recruits, they could be sent pretty much straight ahead to Afghanistan. They would get some training within the unit in Afghanistan. Yes, this is correct.
This does not sound very encouraging.
Well, this was just the Soviet army system. This is how it worked. So the Afghanistan was not considered a war. It was just the unit being in some area. It wasn't considered as it was in the fighting situation. So all those units did follow the same rules as any other regular unit on the mainland would. So the soldier would get into Afghanistan. He would spend some time there. If his officers, his commanders were normal guys, they would, of course, spend some time training him without sending him on any operations. And this was the case in most situations. But this was the case. But before, I think it was 1983 when the proper training facility in Fergana was established. And after that, all soldiers would go either through Fergana or through the specialist training facilities in other cities. So they would only get into Afghanistan after at least 3 months in those training units. But this only started to be the thing in 1983 and further on.
So there's something which you say, you talk about in your book. On one hand, you say you're right, and this is something which you explain. This is a sentence which you, word for word, which is in your book. It says that the soldiers valued their officers' professionalism and their leadership skills. And on the other hand, you talk a lot about something which, we talk about as well as the Russian military. We often talk about it, the Dedovshchina, the rule of grandfathers, which is for people who don't know, it is a traditional phenomenon in the Russian military, in the Soviet military, where the soldiers who enlisted men who just entered the units, they would be abused in different ways by soldiers who were around for longer, and they would be forced to do different menial tasks, and they would be different kinds of physical and emotional abuse. And you say, and it's in your book, and it's in other places, in other books also on this topic, that the officers would allow this to happen. The officers felt that this was part of the military process to have this kind of abuse. So I would like to ask, these two statements, that on one hand, the officers were complicit in this abuse of the enlisted men, on the other hand, the enlisted men really respected their officers. There's a bit of a tension between these two statements.
I understand what you mean.
Maybe it's a false tension. Maybe they are connected. Maybe you can explain.
I can explain. If I'll explain, it will make more sense. So let's say in the regular Soviet Union during the peacetime, not in Afghanistan, the officers would, of course, be valued for keeping decent discipline in the unit, and the soldiers in those units which actually do have the grandfather rule and a lot of mocking, they would pay their officers for allowing this. But in Afghanistan, it was kind of different, you see. So in Afghanistan, soldiers would primarily respect their officers for their abilities to fight and to lead the units in the actual firefights and the battles. And they wouldn't care that much about how officers reacted to the mocking and the grandfather's rule, because this wasn't, at this point, it wasn't their territory. So the sergeants and all the soldiers, they would mock the younger ones, but this was all not as important as actually surviving and winning the firefights.
The officer is there to keep you alive. Does he keep you alive?
Yeah. So during the mocking, you could get beaten up, you can get humiliated to some extent, but it wouldn't be a regular thing for someone to get killed. But in the firefight, of course, you could get killed, and soldiers would respect the officers who were able to command well and who would actually understand what's going on. Because, of course, Afghanistan was a very different terrain and very different scenario for to those which were studied and learned in the Soviet military universities. And lots of officers coming from those universities to Afghanistan, they would blindly follow the book, which was not, which wouldn't work in the Afghanistan conditions, and this would end up in people getting killed without, well, by stupidity, basically. So those officers who could switch on to the new conditions, who could understand the geography, who could understand the scenarios of the firefights, they were very well respected by the soldiers, and of course, soldiers praised them for, well, for picking the battles they could win.
Which brings me around, you know, and your book is specifically, it's specifically about the VDV, the airborne forces of the Soviet Union, and focusing specifically on the 345th Regiment, which is, of course, a very, in Russia, it's a very famous unit. And through this, you tell us the story of the VDV as a whole. But I would like to ask, do you think that through this we can learn also about the problems, the different issues that the broader Soviet military had? What is the lesson here, if I may?
Yeah, absolutely. You can learn about the Soviet military in general, especially if you do not have some particular interest in some very particular units. This book would be very interesting for anyone to have a look at, to read, because in general, it does cover the Soviet army as a whole, because it was one structure. It was pretty similar anywhere. Wouldn't depend where a person would serve, where the regiment would be located. And same goes with all those photographs and the equipment and the weapons. I mean, they were all pretty much the same. They all had some little differences. And for those who especially interested in those, let's say, airborne or navy or whatever, they would definitely need different sources to learn about different services and about different regiments. But for people who have general interest in Soviet Army, Soviet Union, Afghanistan war, this book would be very interesting to have a look at.
And the problems which we talked about with the leadership and the training, these were the same also in the other units, you know, in the Motostrelki or whatever.
It was probably, well, airborne was seen as the most elite part of Soviet service, part of Soviet army, and this was the case. So they were better trained, they were physically better trained, and they had more motivation than regular infantry or other troops. But probably most importantly, the officers serving in the airborne, they were the most, well, they were usually the best ones the Soviet army had. So it was much easier to survive, let's say, in an airborne unit than in an infantry unit, just because the officers would be better prepared for actual firefights.
So, if anything, other units had, you know, an even worse problems with the training than we have seen, what we've described here.
Especially during the earliest period of the war, yes, they were not as well trained. They were not as well. They didn't have that much practice on small arms and grenade launchers as the airborne would. So, like the essential arms of the small scale conflict. But this would all pick up, and let's say by mid-war, most units were on the similar level, with, again, airborne were the elite ones because they just had better officers. But the overall level would pretty much equal out by mid-war, I would say that.
Which brings me, you know, in a very sad way, unfortunately, this book now has a modern-day relevance, which, you know, generally, I don't like it when military history books get a modern day relevance. And of course, you are a citizen of Ukraine, and so, I'm just going to ask: do you think that there are lessons from all of this, from this history book, from the other knowledge which you have, which can tell us about the problems which the Russian army is now experiencing?
Okay. The main problem that Russian army has, in my opinion, or one of the main problems, and it comes from the Soviet times, is that they don't really pay that much attention to the experience the army received anyway in any other conflict. So let's say before the Afghanistan, Soviet army was pretty much like a peacetime army. They didn't have any big conflicts behind their back for a long time. So the Second World War finished in 1945, so like 35 years ago. They had almost no personnel who stayed from the time because they were now older and retired. And there was very little experience from the Hungarian uprising and the situation in Czechoslovakia in 1968. But this was like really limited. And again, it was not well studied in the Soviet institutions. And Afghanistan was has a similar effect, let's say, because Afghanistan was a much longer war. It was a bloodier war. Soviet Union lost quite a few people there, and they could potentially gain and evaluate a lot of experience from the time. But this was not done too well, let's put it this way. So one of my favorite examples to describe what I mean is how the Soviet airborne regiments coming out of Afghanistan handed in all the infantry fighting vehicles, like the BMP-2s and BTRs, and they received the regular airborne ones, so the BMD and BTRD. It doesn't mean much to those who don't know the particular difference in those vehicles, but if you think about it, the airborne specific armored vehicles were really light, cars, basically. It was required so that they can be transported, airlifted, and paradropped with the airplanes. But this doesn't make sense in any modern conflict or in any conflict at all. But this was the situation of this. This is how Russian army operated ever since they left Afghanistan. So all the airborne regiments, they were all armed and crewed, all those airborne-specific, really light aluminium tinfoiled vehicles. And this is what they used at the very first stages of the current invasion. And this played a really, big joke on them, because those are the vehicles which can be easily destroyed even with the smallest amount of firepower, like the 12.7 machine guns. Unlike the BMP-2, which needs something a bit more sophisticated, like an RPG launcher, let's say. So if you see my point, that the Soviet army didn't like to evaluate the small conflict experiences, they didn't like to put it in practice later on. They were always preparing for some sort of a big war. And when it did come, all that experience which could be evaluated and used for practical purposes, well, it wasn't. And they have to learn now from the new mistakes. And, we see how it's going.
Yes, not particularly well, is it? But at least for you and me, this is a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
We are citizens of Western countries here, so while this is the only thing which I think is tragic here is that, first of all, these people have done it to themselves, and second, of course, as I always say, we always need to look at how countries make mistakes, how people make mistakes.
Yes, because it's best to learn from someone else's experience than from your own.
Because, if we start thinking, we are smart, this will not happen to us, we could turn out very, very disappointed in some terrible future.
Absolutely.
There's always a joke, if you cannot be if you cannot serve as an example, it will serve as a terrible warning. And Putin's Russia is unfortunately currently serving as a terrible warning.
Yep.
And I would like to conclude our show with a traditional question. We're all creatures of tradition here. I've mentioned that tradition is very important. Can you tell us maybe if there is some book which you are right now reading which you would like to maybe suggest to the audience as well?
Yes, I actually can. And so this will be the perfect suggestion for this show, I suppose. Right now, I'm almost finished the book called On Writing Well by William Zinsser. And it's basically a guide on how to write well, how to put the words together, how to put sentences together in good paragraphs. And it's a really simple book to read. It's really well written itself, and it helps a lot to someone who doesn't have English as a first language, like myself. And I did pick up a lot of little hints, let's say, and overall ideas of how to be a better writer. And it's definitely important for me now, as the next book I'm writing, it's much more text heavy than this airborne one which we're discussing now. So that it will be like I think around 50,000 to 60,000 words. This is something I would definitely recommend anyone who is working on any writing project or who is planning to do so. Yeah.
If it's a book on writing well, it would be kind of worrisome if it were not well written.
Yeah, that's true.
But I would like to thank you for being on this show, Vlad. And absolutely, when you finish your next book, I would like you to come back to us. This is an invitation.
Oh, great. Thank you, Boris. Yeah, absolutely, I will. I actually hope to finish it really soon. My timetable plan is to finish it by the end of Christmas time, so it will be published early next year.
Hopefully early next year. Thank you for being with us today, Vlad.
Thank you, Boris.